Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 25th of January 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. And we're delighted to say we've got Alex Thompson with Eastern Approaches, who will be speaking on live video Skype link from the Netherlands. Well, the sun is shining, and I think there's a glimmer of light at the end of the tunnel, because we're really beginning to get a picture about what's going on in UK. And in this news, we're going to be taking the lid off what's happening with the European Union's defence policy and very, very serious implications for Britain's nuclear deterrent. But let's kick off with that fake news speciality organisation, the BBC. I think they're reporting truthfully here. Brexit case prompts lawyers to create citizenship lessons. Now, if you get into the text of this, and encourage people to go and have a look at this article, it says that newspaper comments branding judges enemies of the people. Can you imagine that, Mike? After last year's High Court Article 50 ruling have prompted new British constitution lessons for secondary pupils. The lesson resources have been developed by the Bar Council and the Citizenship Foundation, and they explain the judiciary's role in the democratic process. Well, I've got to say, I've seen some judges involved in the democratic process in family courts. I don't think they knew what the Constitution was about or a common law court. But the good news is all of this is being sent free of charge to every secondary school in the UK. And, of course, we can expect the BBC to get fully behind that. Why? Well, if you dig into who's who, let's have a look at the Citizenship Foundation. Here they are. So publications, the Young Citizens Passport, Changing Places, Understanding Citizenship, Citizenship Studies, Money, 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 Your Rights and Responsibilities. So I get a warm feeling from that, Mike.
Yeah, because you cannot have rights without responsibilities.
Okay, well, let's have a look at who's behind them. So we'll bring in a bit of their website. And we've got the citizenship edition of our best-selling guide to the law for young people. It was launched in March, the House of Lords, by a lady called Sherry Booth, QC. I believe that is Tony Blair's wife.
Yes.
Of Matrix Chambers. And is linked into Human Rights Unit and the Duke of Edinburgh's award. And who's at the bottom here? It's our old friend Common Purpose.
Yes.
Working to teach people about citizenship and their rights. And here's the money, money, money. And who've they brought in for that? Well, it's good old Deutsche Bank. I think they're nearly bankrupt at the moment, aren't they?
I think they're more than nearly bankrupt. They are bankrupt.
So Deutsche Bank has been used as a role model in leadership for school children. They're nearly bankrupt, but here they are helping teach children about money and citizenship.
Yep.
And if that's not bad enough, let's have a look at the bottom, because it's supported by the Law Society, bastion of democratic process, and the Cabinet Office, Office for Civil Society. Perhaps we should bring in Alex here. Do you get a warm feeling about this, Alex, that we're being taught how to be citizens?
I do not, Brian, because for those who don't know already, I was a GCHQ officer responsible for the former Soviet Union. And I saw that what we liked to do through the 90s and the 2000s was my time in that setup, is we liked to set up all kinds of civil society bodies, the word that the cabinet officers used, which it never used to use about us, it was always other countries. And we set up these bodies in order to train the population in how to adapt to, well, you could call it neoliberal or neoconservative society, basically the radical middle. Don't be a lefty, don't be a right winger. The third way will get you through. So that's where Madame Blair, sometimes she's Blair, sometimes she's Booth, sometimes she can't make her mind up. That's where she comes into it. Civil society is about reframing the mind and getting people ready for the corporation-led future and away from nasty old ideas of family and nation state and sovereignty.
Yeah, so this is very insidious and dangerous stuff, and it's being pushed right across society in UK.
Yes, it is. Alex, you know, when did, maybe you know this, the answer to this question, but when did rights require responsibilities?
The first I was aware of it was, as often, you need to look at education and particularly primary education. Not that primary teachers are ahead of the curve themselves, but the people who train them are, because primary schools are very useful to their agenda. I noticed in what would it have been, maybe 2000 actually, or maybe a couple of years behind, prior to that, through the windows of a primary school in Bedfordshire, that somebody had got the children to do a display on each of your rights and each of your responsibilities balanced with each other. The children were encouraged to invent fake rights, like you've got a right to play football, and really serious constitutional stuff there. And this was balanced with a responsibility, such as to pick up sweet wrappers. So I think the thinking broke the mainstream in Britain about the late 90s, just after Blair's Year Zero, which probably means it was in the planning in New England and London, Thatcher era, Major era, somewhere around there.
It is incredible, Alex, isn't it, that there is so little understanding, general understanding of the Constitution in this country. I wonder what it's going to take to sort of bring that back.
I wonder if pocket guides would be the way ahead. American constitutionalists of all political persuasions do a great job in producing these folding pocket guides to the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And of course, there was a famous moment in the anti-Trump campaigns before the election where a gentleman who'd immigrated from Pakistan said, "I'll gladly lend you my copy of the Constitution," and waved this slender document at the cameras. Now, if the Americans can do that, perhaps we need to produce Magna Carta. We could do a dual English and Scots version, Magna Carta against the Declaration of Our Oath, the Bill of Rights against the Claim of Right, and so on, and the Coronation Oath in big, perhaps double-sized type at the back of the booklet, and then you'd actually get a guide to the Constitution. If people can't see it, they don't know it's there.
Absolutely. Well, that sounds like a project.
I think that sounds very good. We will speak to the British Constitution Group about that, because obviously that type of work to teach people, inform people, is absolutely in the remit of the British Constitution Group. And it's also fair to say that they have produced, and I believe you gave some help to the booklet on money and the Bradbury Pound. Mm-hmm. So there we go.
Right, we'll have a brief look around Europe at the moment, and starting with the UK. Alex, this from the BBC, Cheshire East schools could face a four-day week. The BBC here reporting that the funding cuts will see schools closing for one day out of the working week. Your point to me earlier was that there have been calls for regime change in other countries for less.
Well, absolutely. If you read policy documents, even at unclassified level, around the early 2000s, about countries such as Moldova, Georgia, Yemen, they were put in the failing state bracket. And the first thing that put them up there was presence of terrorists, by which was meant, tame CIA projects against Russia, but never mind, in the country. And number two was the country is not fulfilling its basic primary public services because it's not taking tax revenue. And these were grounds for regime change in the neoconservative interventionist agenda. Which is covered, by the way, in my talk from the British Constitution Group about the peace and the Westphalian order among nation states. So if we were saying not very long ago with regard to small, weak Eastern European testbed countries, they need a new government because they can't pay their teachers. Well, I wonder what's going on in Britain. That particular story was shared by my aunt, because that's my mother's part of the world, that part of Cheshire. But I've since actually found out that it is already a reality in one English region or district and the Western Isles of Scotland. They have a four-day week in the schools.
Right. Well, let's move to Ireland then. And you wanted to highlight this article from the UK Column website that you've written. County Mayo, Ireland, questionable arrests continue.
Yes, this regards Stephen Manning, who's the tweed-jacketed gentleman there, who had a great run-in with Gardaí, Irish policemen, in a court hearing in September 2015, as a result of which, as the article sets out, he now has been charged with a Section 6 order, public order offence, and has had to defend himself. Now, he's had a lot of jiggery-pokery in defending himself, and it looks like the County Mayo authorities waited till they knew he would be in Dublin pursuing matters with the Supreme Court in order to call him up, the Guard, he called him up on Monday morning and said, where are you? The judge is sitting now for your case. You're in contempt of court. And he said, no, you told me Thursday, not today. So when he came back to Mayo from Dublin that evening on the train, Monday evening, he was arrested and held overnight. A couple of us from Germany, as well as here in the Netherlands, who are journalists, called Claire Morris Garda Station, who were a bit shirty, but, well, they stayed civil, but they were a bit annoyed to have us call them. He has now been given a two-month suspended sentence by Judge Ineas McCarthy. At the root of all this, if you trace back Mr. Manning's woes, it goes back to a time he lived on Achill Island off the west coast of Mayo, which is exactly where the Doherty family had a lot of the worst episodes happen to them, including once the children were taken off them temporarily in that case. And Mr. Manning has since found out that the brothers, whom he seems to have crossed in some inadvertent way, are actually second cousins to one of the TDs, the Irish MPs for the county of Mayo, none other than Taoiseach or Prime Minister Enda Kenny.
Okay, and well, you mentioned the radical middle a moment ago, and this is a Dutch article. Tell us a little bit about what's going on here.
You'll see on the screen there, normaal doen, which is not acting up, as it were, but doing normal, doing like everyone does. This is the greatest virtue in the Dutch pantheon of virtues. And Prime Minister Mark Rutte, who is actually the only European Prime Minister from his country's Liberal Party, it's called the VVD in the Netherlands. It's a bit like a cross between the Liberal and the Tories, but he's the only Liberal in power in Europe. He is desperate that in March the Dutch people do not elect Geert Wilders, who was pledged to put a stop to mass immigration, particularly from certain problem spots like the Moroccan Berbers. But Wilders was recently condemned by a court in the Netherlands for having said we don't want any more Moroccans in the country. It was found to be discriminatory, although the Dutch constitution only speaks about racism, and the Moroccans are apparently not a race, but that's how it is. And that's only given him a boost in the polls. So Rutte is trying to steal a bit of his rhetoric off him, but I thought it was a bit pathetic, because if you look at the Breitbart News London write-up by Oliver J.J. Lane, you'll see that Rutte is really having to pretend to be like Wilders without actually admitting that he's there. So he's saying, go away, all you naughty, misbehaving boys. But he has to expand the message to everyone in society at the same time, so it gets thinned out to the point of nonsense. It shows that things are he's very worried. You'll also find that there was a meeting of Wilders and all his like-minded people like Marine Le Pen, all of those, you might call them, alt-right political parties from the European continent, met in Koblenz in Western Germany a few days ago, and they have a united platform for a number of general elections being held in key EU states this year. So you may find a couple more of the establishment parties that are out on their ear by the end of the year.
Okay, and well, let's move to Macedonia. Just before I do this, I'll just say apologise for the audio from Alex's connection at the moment. We did try to make the connection a few times, and it is a Skype issue today, so I do apologise about that. This is an article, Massive Movement to Overthrow George Soros Explodes in Macedonia. I was asked the question yesterday, Alex, is what's going on around the world a real global movement starting to build? Is that what we're starting to see here?
It looks like it. Macedonia has had a particular problem because it is a tiny country of not much more than a million people. It's landlocked. And you know the old saying about when such and such sneezes, so and so catches a cold. Well, if Europe sneezes, then I think Macedonia definitely catches a cold because it has very little to protect itself. It's got very few resources. It's quite a poor country. And they have really realised en masse now that it's the first nation that's really where it's broken mainstream national consciousness, that George Soros personally is behind a lot of the agenda. And a lot of the fiddling in Macedonian politics to get pro-NATO politicians to the helm seems to have involved Soros personally as well. The same people and the same funding channels are involved. So it's pretty staggering there to see in neon nettle that you know, that many people are out on the streets, if indeed that picture is from Skopje. I believe it is. I haven't managed to source the picture. But, you know, Skopje is one of the smallest capital cities of one of the smallest countries in Europe. So, you know, multiply that by 10 to understand what it would be like in the Netherlands, or by 100, perhaps, to understand what it would be like in Britain or Germany. That many people are out. Is the audio any better, by the way, now?
It is, Alex. we'll discuss we'll discuss that later. Now, business in Macedonia. I'm also hearing that there are similar protests, not so much against the sort of Soros NGO complex, but particularly against NATO in the Balkans and Poland as well, to a lesser degree, but certainly in other parts of the old Soviet republics. Are you hearing any of that being discussed?
I am seeing some of it. There has been a core of people in the Russian-speaking countries who've been aware of Soros for a long time, longer than Britain, which is odd because Britain was the first country he attacked with his speculation. But there has been a lot of that for a long time anyway. I am getting a slight sense that other Eastern European countries which don't speak Russian have started writing their own stuff now or copying Russian language material. So you are seeing more from Poland. The big one is really the buckle of the belt country in the middle of Europe, which determines the whole of Eastern Europe's attitude, and that's Hungary. Because they have actually taken steps, along with a couple of other countries now, like Macedonia, to outlaw anything that has Soros' fingerprints on it. And there's been obviously wails of protests from Budapest NGO world, but the government fortunately does not care.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, if that's what's going on at the bottom end of, we'll say the bottom end of the system. In Europe, this is what's going on at the top end. Now, just a brief recap. We've reported on what Ms. Mogherini has been up to over the last couple of days, taking place in meetings to do with stability in the Middle East, because, of course, European unions help promote stability in the Middle East, but also these discussions with NATO Secretary Jens Stoltenberg, redefining Europe's security agenda. Now, I'm going to say to our audience today, we are about to take the lid off what's really happening with the European defence policy and the planned integration of British and French nuclear deterrent forces. This is not being reported in any other news source in UK, so this is an exclusive to UK column today, and the implications of this country are astonishing. But here's this lady. She's never had any job in security or the military. She's a professional EU political office worker. And she's saying we've hardened soft power. We've done more on defence in the last 7 months than decades. We've got a three-pronged set of measures to strengthen the EU's security and defence capability in a reshaping world. The only way for Europeans to be global players is through the EU. So that last sentence says you can't act alone. The only way that you can play in our club is you've got to be under the control of the EU centralised government. Now, a very big thank you to a viewer who was clearly paying attention to what we've been talking about there, because they sent us through earlier this morning this document, and this is the European Defence Action Plan. And obviously, there's too much there to go through in our news today, but just to give a little bit of flavour of President Juncker, he stressed in his 2016 State of the Union speech the need for a Europe that protects, empowers and defends. It's going to have hard as well as soft security, and it's getting into everything. Collaborative approaches, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, drones, satellites. But he also talks about including strategic enablers, and we'll tell you where that goes in a minute, capabilities to ensure cyber and maritime security. And then a key bit that David Ellis from Strategic Defence Initiatives has been talking about, the drawing together of the procurement and the military-industrial procurement base. So this is, without any doubt, Europe going for fully centralised military forces. Now, we're delighted to say that David Ellis and Strategic Defence Initiatives have put out a brilliant document highlighting what's really been going on. And at the bottom of this quote, at the bottom of the page here, as it were, we just highlight this quote. And I'm going to say, Alex, you found this one, and we've got a set slide on it. But this is a gentleman saying everything now must be put on the table, from higher EU military spending to, quote, a British-French nuclear defence shield for the continent. So we've got Theresa May trying to tell Britain we are pulling out of the European Union, but in the background, exceptionally dirty work in order to couple Britain to the French nuclear deterrent. And of course, who is ultimately in control of Europe's defence? And that has got to be the Germans. So, Alex, take us through this article which revealed this secret to you.
Deutsche Welle is the external service of the German establishment, the one which competes with BBC World Service, Voice of America, Radio France Internationale, that kind of outfit. And Deutsche Welle's Max Hoffmann here, at least it seems to be written by him, he appears with a photo and a caption halfway down, but he's not given a byline at the top. But it's an opinion piece, so it is, in any case, it's from Deutsche Welle corporately, and probably by him personally, says that we need to have everything on the table because of awful Trump and his awful American isolationism. And having bewailed Brexit, as every continental publication does at the moment, he goes seamlessly from that to saying, well, now that the Americans are turning their backs on us and the British apparently are leaving the EU, we need, as in Germany, to control the British nuclear assets, and we'll do that by calling it Franco-British, but it'll be controlled from Berlin. This from the same German media establishment, which is giving us a new Abwehr, a word which historians of a certain period will recognise very well. This one is an Abwehr against fake news, which is going to sit between Facebook and the public.
Right, Alex, if I can just stress that, what we're talking about is a scam being played on the British public that integration of nuclear assets is enacted with the French in order for people just to think it's Britain getting together with the French. But in fact, that's just a stepping stone to the EU getting control of our strategic nuclear deterrent. And ultimately, it won't even be the French that's pulling the strings. It's going to be the Germans. Now, if some people think that that's just rhetoric within that particular article, let's bring in some basic information. This is easily available on the. This is part of the Lancaster House, the 2010 Lancaster House Declaration, which Cameron cooked up with no debate in Westminster. He then signs the document with Sarkozy in November 2010. And these are the key things. Defence and Security Cooperation Treaty between British and French Armed Forces. Note the mutual independence. The moment you've got interdependence, you are breaking down the ability of a nation state to act alone. We've got nuclear stockpile stewardship. I'll come back to that. Operational matters, letters of intent for the exchange of UK and French armed forces, and industry and armaments. It's not just going to be the equipment and the men in the field. It's the whole background of procurement and making the armaments in the first place. But here it is, because what they were talking about was another stepping stone through this magic phrase, nuclear stockpile stewardship. If you read the detail of what was going on here, Britain suddenly in 2010 wasn't able to look after its own nuclear weapons. We had to get into bed with the French. We had to set up joint Anglo-French facilities for dealing with those nuclear weapons. We now know that this was simply the stepping stone to the next phase, which is the amalgamation of the British and French nuclear deterrent. And hey, presto, we do not exist as a nation anymore. Alex,
well, just before, sorry. I was just going to say, Brian, I mean, the hypocrisy here is immense. It's staggering, particularly when you bear in mind that this, as you say, this 2010 agreement was simply announced. It wasn't debated. It wasn't voted on. There was no act of parliament. There was no challenge in the Supreme Court. There was no nonsense like that going on at that time. It was just presented by Cameron and Clegg as being a done deal.
A 50-year done deal.
Yeah. And yet many of the same MPs that stayed silent over that absolutely undemocratic move are the ones that are out howling about the undemocratic moves to leave the European Union at the moment, in inverted commas. That's what they say.
Absolutely.
But they said nothing about this, which is clearly an undemocratic move
in
2010.
Undemocratic is a true expression, Mike, but it's a rather gentleman's expression. This is absolute treason. This is complete deceit on the nation state, on Britain. The public are being lied to by Theresa May, Prime Minister, and Michael Fallon, the Defence Secretary. Because what they are doing is giving away the ability of this country to defend itself. Now, you may be somebody who doesn't agree with nuclear weapons, and we can totally accept that point. That's another debate. The issue is here we have those weapons. They are being given away to the control of the French and then the Germans, i.e. the EU, by lying to the nation. And how big are the lies? Well, we just picked one article here. Michael Fallon vows to oppose the EU army despite the Brexit vote. This is an absolute lie. Not only is he not opposing the EU army, he is giving away Britain's military and he's giving away our nuclear deterrent. Well, what sort of man is he? I've been fascinated as to where this man comes from. Well, thanks to WikiLeaks, but this is real information and you can check it out yourselves. As a student, he was involved with the European movement. He was an activist for the EU and the Yes Youth campaign. And then he gets involved with the Conservatives. He's working with Lord Carrington. And there he is as European desk officer. I don't know whether you'd like to comment on that at all, Alex, but I follow these people through. They are utter liars in what they're presenting to the British public.
Yes, Brian, you mentioned there the fateful period of the mid-1970s when a lot of the then young Tory MPs got going who are now senior or lords. And he's not the only one. I would urge people to read, it's still on the front page of the UK Column website at the moment, David Ellis's article called Rolls-Royce and BAE Systems Going Cheap. It's a long read of 6,000 words, and it needs some digesting and to follow the links. But there's a couple of things I want to pick out of it at this point. One is that in the same period, Michael Heseltine was the Minister for Aeronautical Industry. I forget the exact title of his junior minister role. And he failed to sell Concorde, so that Concorde flopped. And this, of course, was repeated 10 years later in the mid-80s with the Westland affair, when Westland helicopters were, well, Leon Britton, a cabinet colleague of Heseltine's, wanted it flogged off to Sikorsky in America. So there's a long history of this. Two things that David brings out which are strategic in that piece about Rolls-Royce and BAE Systems going cheap. One is that at the European Council meeting at Fontainebleau outside Paris in 1984, Jacques Delors, he spells it out in the article, who was the then president of the Commission when there were 10 member states, said, "I have three ideas, ladies and gentlemen," to the heads of government this was, "to relaunch ever closer union. One, military union, which he called la défense commune. Two, a single currency, la monnaie unique, I think he called it. And three, removal of national member states' vetoes over policy." Mrs. Thatcher said, "No, no, no." At which point the Tory wets, including Heseltine, Howarth was on the scene at that time, although he was not posing as a wet, and all of the others, said, "Mrs. Thatcher, we are not going to permit you to say no, no, no in public or even suggest a future possibility of military union." Well, 6 years later, just before she got stabbed in the back, in October 1990, she had a final opportunity to say, "Mr. Delors has proposed three things." These were three new things, right, that the Commission should be a government, basically, and so on. And she said in the House of Commons, "No, no, no." And this awoke the memory of 1984, 6 years earlier, in the Tory wets. And they removed her within a matter of days of saying that. That's how explosive European military union was. Delors didn't even pretend that it wasn't on the table in 1984. You know, when a lot of these guys were still young. So that's a very important point to make there. I forget the other just now, but I think you get the idea. And before I forget to say, that research paper by SDA, which people have been asking for a link for, if you look at my Twitter account, I have tweeted it this morning, and it will also be going out before long under a brief article heading by David Ellis, so people can share it that way as well.
Yeah, I've got a thank you, Alex. I've got an eye on the clock here, but very quickly, we just push this through. What sort of man is Fallon? Well, we can see his duplicitous nature, excuse me, over EU defence. But it's remarkable, this man, what's his business running a chain of children's nurseries? I mean, how do you jump from that to looking after the defence of this nation? Well, perhaps it explains why we're seeing our nuclear deterrent being given away. This is just part of the comment from the excellent SDI paper. "The recent British Brexit referendum has made no difference to the speed and tenacity with which the Conservative government under Theresa May and Secretary of State for Defence Michael Fallon are continuing the path to EU military action." So there we are. Utter treason. And UK Column today is the only media outlet in UK putting this information out. You will not read this on the BBC, any of the other national papers. This is absolutely exclusive.
Alex, this little video clip you wanted to highlight, and you mentioned Gerald Horth a moment ago, and he has, I suppose, a starring role in it.
He does indeed. You can see him there holding his hand up as he stands and speaks, and you can see people turning around in disdain. And this is because on Monday evening, the all-party parliamentary group on Ukraine held an event which was actually at Portcullis House, the secure new building attached to the House of Commons. And there he is sitting alongside a Ukrainian MP, and he was interrupted as he was speaking. Now, I don't know whether you've put a caption on this, but otherwise I will read it out myself.
I do, right. So Horace said, the all-party parliamentary group on Ukraine exists to ensure that the UK Parliament is constantly aware of the challenges that are faced by Ukraine. And the person who interjected, Graham Phillips, said, will you be commenting on how Ukraine is shelling and killing citizens, civilians in Donbass? Because I think that should be on the agenda. And the audience turning around and saying, liar. Shut up, get him out.
You will see this at 6 minutes in a YouTube clip called Why Does the UK Support Ukrainian Shelling? By Graham Phillips, an independent British journalist who's obviously been to Donbass in eastern Ukraine a lot. The point here in what this ties together with the European Military Union is this. Gerald Howarth was the junior Minister for Defence, particularly armaments, around the time of during the Strategic Defence Review 2010, the SDSR. He took the responsibility, the front end, for decisions about all the things that were scrapped then. If I'm not wrong, that included the Nimrods, the decision was taken then, and the three aircraft carriers. And afterwards, he muttered words piously about, difficult decisions had to be taken. Well, look at his history. He's got some very interesting, you know, you might say solid conservative credentials, you know, Freedom Association and all those bodies, Conservative Future. But if you look at his background a bit more, you see that he was in banking for a long time, including manager for 2 years of the European Arab Bank, and a stint with the Bank of America. And it's my contention and that of David Ellis that Howarth was parachuted to pose as a hard Tory right-winger and patriot, which he often beats his chest about, by the way. He often says things like, if I got to be minister, I would like to be called Minister of War. That's how much of a rabble-rouser he is. We think that he was put there really to implement the agenda of the Bank for International Settlements and all the others. Look at the talks from the British Constitution Group conference in Winchester if you don't know how the BIS feeds into it. This is banking policy for which he's acting as the front man.
And so Graham Phillips then eventually removed from the room.
He is, and he keeps saying, why is this massacre happening in Ukraine? And the guard pushes him out. Well, the reason why the massacres are happening with British support in Ukraine and why Howarth wants to cozy up to the Ukrainians there is, of course, that Syria has now failed. Look at David Ellis's previous articles about this, all on the website, and the most recent ones linked back to the previous ones. Syria has not turned out to be the great excuse for European military integration and intervention. The next straw to clutch at is Trump is leaving us America's isolationist. We need an EU army or EU armed forces. And the one beyond that, as you've mentioned before, Mike, yourself, is Ukraine as another conflagration which sucks Europe in and again, with German strategic interests at heart, persuades us all that we need to have a united European military response. So there's a lot of that. He was sitting next to a Ukrainian MP there, Svetlana Zalishuk, who has a very interesting past. I know we're running short of time here, but she was actually a journalist to start off with. She was chairwoman of a body called Obshchee Prostranstvo, which means common space. Very interesting name. And by the way, that very name is used in Scotland of another questionable body. She's close to Mikhail Saakashvili, the former president of Georgia, who went off to be a governor of a region in Ukraine. Her party has a name which her party is now called Democratic Alliance, and it used to be called the Euro-Optimists Party or party grouping. Very interesting lady indeed. And on your next slide there, I think you might have passed it, she actually promised to strip naked and run through the streets of Kiev. There we are, that tweet there, because she was one of the founders, this MP who was a Ukrainian MP who was sitting next to Howarth on the stage at that event. She was one of the founders of Euromaidan, that Sorosite movement that
toppled the elected president of Ukraine at the time. So that's who Sir Gerald Howarth is in bed with, as it were, not literally, I hasten to add. He's in bed with Ukraine's Lady Godiva, uttering nonsense to us about how Ukraine is facing a great risk and we must shore up Ukraine militarily. Very, very questionable people indeed.
Okay, right. Now, as you say, we are short of time, so just a couple of minutes on this. Another article from the UK Column website, Fake News, Debunking the Debunkers. Now, this arose out of an Express article, which I understand has subsequently been taken down from the Express, which was supposedly debunked by the Canary website. You can explain what they got right and what they got wrong in their debunking of the Express article. The Express article suggesting what? That Angela Merkel calling for EU military?
Yes, absolutely. Sorry about the intermittent angle grinder out here. I am in a city centre. But the point is that the journalist at the Express called Nick Gutteridge, who I'm a bit harsh about, to be honest, because he doesn't speak German. I think he was pretending that he did to some extent. He wrote the original piece saying Angela Merkel gave this speech at the Belgian university in honour of her, by the way. She was getting a gong. And she said in this speech, that's what's at issue. He reported what she said as, we need European military union, although she didn't use those words. Now, he doesn't write the headings because journalists don't. So a sub-editor sexed this up to her saying UK and US are weak in capital letters. And of course, this is what the Canary picked up on. Xenophobic, they said, no evidence for it in the speech, which, by the way, they didn't link to either. So it was the Canary is just like the Express, whom it's debunking. It's saying, take it from us. Well, UK Column, me in this instance, we like to provide sources. So we quote her in German. I give her give you a verbatim translation and analysis of what she did say. And it's all pointing towards European military integration, everything she said. So you see, okay, and not a very accurate journalist, but his heart's in the right place, Mr. Gutteridge. And he's tweeted me back since saying the decision to pull his article was taken way above his level and he doesn't have a copy of the article anymore. So I think something's a bit untowards going on there. But the idea is that now we've got used to fake news as a concept. If you come along, the Canary in this instance, and say, debunk, debunk, there's no EU military union, that satisfies a certain kind of lazy reader and they don't go on to look any further. Look at the debunking itself, because that has an agenda just like anyone else.
Yes. Okay, well, let's move on then. Baroness Shields, was speaking at she gave the opening speech at the Global Counterterrorism Forum. This is a couple of weeks ago, about a week ago now. She's Parliamentary Undersecretary of State for Internet Safety and Security. And as I say, she was giving that speech at the Global Counterterrorism Forum. UK and the United Arab Emirates are co-chairs of that. And she was saying that, the next 3 days provide us with an opportunity to improve our understanding of the complex challenges we face and to drive forward a collective agenda to develop communications and co-governance approaches to tackle the exploitation and manipulation of the open internet by terrorists and violent extremists. And so they're saying that to be successful, they need to be coordinated. And so they've got the right people in the right room to bring about change, because change is what's needed here, she can and she will act. To focus our thinking, she said, let me address a few key points. First, the specific nature of the threat. Second, our collective response and our progress to date. And third, what further preventative action needs to be taken. And when she got onto the subject of the collective response, she said a new partnership is required. Where all parties, governments, civil society, industry, the media, work together to tackle terrorist and violent extremism use of the internet. And she finished by saying, we all have a shared interest in ensuring that the internet continues to be safe, free and open space. And Alex, just very briefly, I'm not quite sure how you, what she's talking about effectively is censorship, and you may have a different, people have different views on what that means. But how do you stop so-called terrorists? And what is the definition of terrorism anyway in this case? How do you stop so-called terrorists from using the internet and yet keep the internet free and open for everybody else? How is that possible?
It is, of course, not possible. I remember when I was in church once in Eastern Europe, and one of the old-style preachers was preaching against the evils of the internet because it could radicalise people and there was so much porn on it and so on. And the chap next to me whispered, you know, is he going to preach against motorways next because people speed down the M6 to commit adultery? You know, it's the internet is a means to connect people with information. It is in itself morally neutral. And, you know, and any way of suggesting you can filter, block or educate is simply dependent on an understanding of human nature, which is many faceted and greatly flawed. Yeah. But there's never any excuse for censorship. I thought we had this sorted in the 1640s when John Milton wrote Areopagitica on the freedom of the press. But apparently people have forgotten that.
Yes, indeed.
OK, well, we can follow on nicely with that, because this gentleman, Robert Hannigan, who's the director of GCHQ, has decided to step down. He's had rather a lot to say for himself. He said that after a great deal of thought, he's decided this is the right time to move on, allow someone else to lead GCHQ through its next phase. I'm a great enthusiast for our history, and I think it's right that a new director should be firmly embedded by our centenary in 2019. My question at the top is, what is the next phase? I'll just run through these and I'll hand over to you, Alex. He goes on to say he's very committed to GCHQ's future and will, of course, be happy to stay in post until a replacement is selected. He's enjoyed his service in Northern Ireland, Downing Street, the Cabinet Office, Foreign Office, but they've all demanded a great deal of my ever patient and understanding family, and now's the right time for a change in direction. So he's having us believe this is because his family need him. And then he says, well, we've done a brilliant job. He's proud of what we've achieved in these years, not least setting up the National Cyber Security Centre and building greater public understanding of our intelligent work. Proud of the relentless 24-hour operational effort against terrorism, crime and many other national security threats. But, of course, this work's got to remain secret. Now, I'm just going to put in here that I'm fascinated by this organisation that can monitor hundreds of thousands, millions of telephone calls, emails, thousands of pages of social media, but it just can't identify the extensive high-level paedophile network which we know is infesting our political and higher establishment. And I had a conversation earlier this week with yet more information saying the police almost at war at the moment, with policemen wanting to do their job and bring these high-level paedophiles to book, and other policemen totally rotten, closing them down. But GCHQ's there in the background. They're stopping international terrorists. They know what terrorists are thinking in the Middle East while they're having their coffee and doing whatever else they do. But in UK, they just don't seem to be able to get to grips with these paedophile networks. Alex, I would like to see GCHQ put some evidence on the table to prove that they are protecting this nation. I do not think it's good enough that they're getting billions of pounds and simply able to say, well, we're doing a good job, but it's also secret, we can't tell you. Am I being cynical here?
You're not, Brian, because MPs who are not cleared to see intelligence still demand an unclassified summary, although that still is a restricted summary in that it doesn't go general. And this is what they're presented with then is a version of an intelligence agency's success with all the details stripped out. And that's known as sanitized intelligence. And it's quite routine. Of course, there have been a couple of famous cases where NSA have been told to sanitize bits of intelligence, for example, regarding Gaddafi's involvement in Lockerbie before the Gaddafi bombing. It's well-known way of doing things. And I would say that GCHQ owes it to the nation now to sanitize and produce a list for the public of what it's done over the past 12 months. I've seen such things before, from the security service at Thames House, but from GCHQ as well, of, you know, we have stopped N number of plots and whatever. Obviously, there's things you can't mention at all, but there are ways of getting it down to unclassified level. You asked the question of what is going on with Hanegar's resignation. Well, he strikes me as a very different kind of character to my first director, GCHQ, who was Sir Francis Richards. Quite an arrogant man he was, who refused to accept what he was being told about how people were leaving the service dissatisfied. And he went off to be governor of Gibraltar at a crucial juncture just before we all moved into the donut, the new building, causing a lot of sour grapes. Actually, he was leaving us to face the problems that his committee had created, his board. But this is a different kind of resignation. If you say family, it's usually code, as a couple of people in the chat room have said, for I'm out in my ear. And this is a polite way of avoiding being sacked. I wonder if someone's been lined up who is more prepared to sell GCHQ almost as a franchise. Because GCHQ technology, as we've seen in the Doherty case above all, seems to have been spun out to Police Scotland and a number of even quite regional and district level councils. You know, you see that as well with the new Regulatory Powers Act. So I think the GCHQ's technology is not unique anymore. And you'll also have seen in David Ellis's article, which I mentioned about Rolls-Royce and BAE Systems being sold cheap, that one of the things that the EU has already decided to do late last year is to create a single intelligence capacity or capability. So as with the military technology, the more the Americans realise this, the more they're going to pull the plug on their lion's share of the pool, which we have among the Five Eyes countries. So I think Hanegar, one of the reasons he may have gone is jumping ship, because he realises that GCHQ is not going to have a great amount of American input anymore at this rate.
Okay, thanks for that. And we'll just briefly end on Mosul here, because it's all good news. Apparently, if you're following the mainstream press, we've got the Mail here saying Iraqi forces retake last area of Mosul east of the Tigris River. Well, we've got France 24 here saying Iraq embedded with the special forces in Mosul. It's all good stuff. The Guardian, Iraqi forces in Mosul performing at their peak, says US commander. We've got the BBC saying Mosul battle children returned to schools and recaptured East. So it's fantastic stuff. And if you believe what the government says, Tobias Elwood saying that we welcome the progress made by Iraqi forces in eastern Mosul, which marks another step towards defeating Daesh. There is still a long way to go as Iraqi forces prepare for western Mosul. I pay tribute to their bravery and urge them to continue to put the protection of Mosul's innocent civilians at the heart of everything they do. But of course, that isn't what's going on. And it's the hypocrisy here and the contrast between what's going on in Mosul and what happened in Aleppo, which is really what I'm wanting to highlight once again, because the mainstream media not mentioning the words civilian anywhere to be seen. Tobias Elwood mentions them, but isn't really concerned about them too much, because he's not shouting at the people that are trying to remove ISIS from Mosul. The United Nations here saying that the reports from inside Western Mosul are distressing. The prices of basic food and supplies are soaring. Many families without income are eating only once a day. Others are being forced to burn furniture to stay warm. And they're concerned about 189,000 displaced civilians and 750,000 civilians living within Western Mosul, and civilians being shot by ISIS as they attempt to leave the area. And it's all pretty much exactly what was going on in Aleppo, except that in Aleppo we criticised the people that were trying to liberate East Aleppo from ISIS, but in Mosul it's all fine because it's us doing the job and not the Russians.
Utter hypocrisy. Total. Disgusting hypocrisy. Alex, 30 seconds on anything you'd like to close with, if indeed you do.
Yes, I have remembered what the other thing was that I wanted to highlight from that very long read of David Ellis's article about Rolls-Royce and BAE Systems. It's this, that Rolls-Royce told the MOD when the MOD tried to change the order for nuclear reactors that now you've just want 4 instead of 12 of these reactors. It will still be the same price because we've sunk our money into designing them already. At which the MOD said, doesn't matter, we will still pay full whack and take 4 instead of pay full whack and take all 12. Now, the only way in which that makes any sense is if there was, as David puts it, an overriding policy objective from outside Britain that Britain must not have an independent and self-sufficient nuclear deterrent.
Yeah, Alex, thank you very much for that. Well, we'll end on the note. We have had an exclusive UK column news today on the 25th of January 2017. It's taken the UK column to tell the British public, the wider British public, that Theresa May and her Conservative government with Defence Secretary Michael Fallon utterly lying to the nation over Brexit as she gives away Britain's nuclear deterrent, first of all, to the French, but ultimately that is only a stepping stone to EU control of our nuclear deterrent. And on that very serious note, we will leave you. If you like what we do, please continue to support and please subscribe, because we can only run with your financial help. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.